All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome once again to All the Rage. Thank you very much for tuning in. And I'm very happy to say that once again, I am blessed with the presence of a guest. Please introduce yourself.
Hi. Well, thanks to you as well. I want to say first for having me on. My name is Saeed Taji Farouqi. I'm a filmmaker, Palestinian, Egyptian, British filmmaker and teacher, educator in a variety of ways, and starting to do some programming of films, which is where we met.
Yes, a wonderful program. In fact, let's give it a shout out quickly now, because that was The Yellow in Wembley, which is mm-hmm. lovely. Space, lovely venue in the middle of a truly hideous postmodernist monstrosity of architecture.
Yeah, it's very easy to get lost. Run by a group called Other Cinemas.
Yeah.
I mean, the cinema night is run by Other Cinemas, yeah.
Yeah, also they helped, one of the groups that helped to keep you sane during the lockdowns with many of their online events. So films, filmmaking, where did you start, mate? What kind of got you into films? Did you always want to be a filmmaker? Did you fall in love with cinema at a young age? Tell me your story.
Yeah. I think I'm one of those people that if you, if you'd asked me as an 8-year-old, I probably would have said I wanted to make films. So it's always been a real love of mine. I think it was always when I was a kid, actually, it was almost like, it's a very cliche answer, to be honest, but it was just an escape. You know, I grew up in a very violent house. And so for me, when I started to realize that films created another world, so partly it was a way to escape, but it was also a world where a lot of these quite difficult questions that I was faced with were being asked as well. And sometimes being answered, but sometimes just being explored in a way that made me realize, I think, that I wasn't alone in what I was going through. So I think that's one of the reasons why I was, even when I was younger, I was really attracted to quite dark films that for me were sort of really, benchmark films in my kind of obsession with cinema. And, probably films that were a bit too, not inappropriate for me, say as a 10-year-old, but probably not the kind of films most 10-year-olds are watching, but stuff that that was really quite dark or quite deep or quite challenging, in terms of what it was asking. And I think also, I grew up here a bit in London, but also in the Middle East. And so, when I was in the Middle East, I was living in Bahrain, and there was only really one theater that was playing films, foreign films, foreign meaning not Arabic films, sorry, European and American films. And so there was also a cinema show on TV. They had kind of an hour every week where they would review the latest releases. And that for me was also just very exciting as a kind of window into another world. So it was almost like I would watch a lot of shows about the making of films, because I was, I loved watching them, but I never really understood how this thing came to be. And so it was those films that were almost like my film education, because I've never been to film school. So to be honest, that was the only film education I had. But it was just watching these shows. So it was like 50% this kind of real excitement about a new release, and 50% this kind of much more sort of creative curiosity about how this world that I was seeing on screen was being made.
Yeah, I'm thinking we're roughly the same age. So I can remember that anticipation when a film came out in America, but not yet in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have the internet to see the trailers, but somehow you got wind of something, or you heard about something being made, or in my case, sometimes read it in the back of a comic book that I picked up in my local area, and thought, oh wow, they've made a film. Yeah. Like that. is on the way, and God, the anticipation.
yeah. No, it was really exciting. And I would read film magazines, you know.
Yeah.
Which was also, for me, the more interesting part. You know, I was never so much into the industry as this kind of spectacle. But the interesting thing for me was the interviews with filmmakers. It was like trying to understand how other people got immersed in this world.
Yeah.
So that I could do it. You know, and I started making films with my parents' camcorder, you know, as soon as they started buying it. So and that they were kind of like a lot of families in the 80s and 90s, you know, they were really into the new cameras and new technology and ways of recording family holidays and things like that. And then for me, that became my kind of experimental, where I would see how camera works and how camera moves. And so I was always making, you know, like I was always making stuff with moving image.
Yeah. Was there any particular cinema that stood out for you at a young age? Did you like, I mean, I'm thinking, was it films coming from the Middle East? Was it films coming from America? Was it documentary over fiction, or any particular kind of filmmakers? When did you get into that stage? I'm going to make an assumption here because this is what I did. When did you get into that stage when you saw something directed by so-and-so? You're like, oh, I've got to see the rest of that person's films because that was great.
That was probably quite late. I mean, I think early on it was just a fascination with film's ability to transport me somewhere else and make me feel something very, very profound. You know, it was almost like, so there's two films I remember really distinctly as a kid. And these were both, I remember also watching them on a VHS that my dad had recorded off the TV. So one of them was Papillon, the original Papillon, which is about a French, you know, wrongly convicted man who gets sentenced to life on this island. It's played by Steve McQueen. And the thing I remember most is that they plan. I mean, sorry, there's a spoiler for the film for those of you who haven't seen this film, but it's about.
It's 40. Old enough. I think we can.
Yeah, I think it's fine. So the whole film is the Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman character planning how to escape from this island. And then at the very end, Dustin Hoffman decides not to go. And I remember just being fascinated by this decision as a kid, because it's a very complex moral issue. And I just couldn't understand it, you know, because there was a lot that I wanted to escape as a kid. And so I thought, and this idea of injustice, you know, when you're young also, it's like very profound, this idea. It's like, it's so unacceptable that he was wrongly imprisoned, Steve McQueen's character. So, and the system was unjust anyway. So to find this character who in the end is almost too scared to liberate himself, I just found it really fascinating. So I remember watching that film over and over again. And then the other one was The Mission, the Roland Joffé film, where again, you know, this really strong, I mean, obviously it's a film about colonialism. So that I think subconsciously, although I was not politically active at all in those days, but that was really compelling to me. And a film, you know, in which the characters come to realize the brutality of colonialism. But there's also this sense of guilt in Robert De Niro's character, who's desperately trying to redeem himself, you know, by punishing himself. And I think because there was so much violence around me as a kid, that was a fascinating idea. It was like suffering, but in order to become a better person, you know. I'd never seen that before. I'd never contemplated how that could transform your life. And I know, you know, now it's sort of whatever, 30 years later, when I look back at it, I can kind of psychoanalyze why I got really into those films as a kid. But at the time, that's just what I was watching, and there was something I loved about it, you know.
Just a similar thing. My experiences were certainly going to the cinema a bit, but it was mainly having a local video shop with a guy behind the counter who actually had a quite profound effect on me, because when I was a kid, he took me seriously, which I didn't realize that's what I was looking for, but I was.
Yeah.
Because he said, oh, you've seen shitloads of films and you clearly know a lot about them, even though you're 10, 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to me like an adult. So on the off chance you're listening, Jazz, from Dynamite Videos, thank you, man.
You had a great trip. Where
was that? Ryslip Manor. It's in Metline country.
Okay.
It's the place for the store is still there, but the store is long gone.
Yeah, same. I remember I went to visit the Video City where I had, you know, those similar experiences. Of course, it's not there anymore. I mean, none of the stores are. But the cinema, at least the cinemas I used to go to, most of them still exist, which is really nice.
Yeah, you'd walk in and he'd go, oh, you like that? Check this out.
Oh, see, that's great. No, I really didn't get into, you know, the culture of cinema until much later. So I was watching a lot of films as a kid, but it was much more haphazard, I would say.
Well, also, I know I didn't do this for a while, but he got me into the idea of what we used to call foreign films. It's your foreign film, isn't it? And I didn't know. I mean, I grew up among a very loving family, but I grew up in a pretty chauvinistic background. And in this part of where I come from, and the idea of watching, you know, something with subtitles or whatever was but he was one of the first guys who said to me, oh, I saw this action film from India.
Oh, cool.
And he couldn't get hold of it in those days because, again, the way in which you got hold of films, you know, you have living in and around London. Yeah, there were specialist places you could go to in those days to get Hong Kong action films, to get Indian cinema. And they'd be in areas with sort of a high content or more in central London where you get stuff like that. Very, very specialist. I don't particularly like the ghettoization of art, but at the same time, I kind of enjoyed those going to this. But yeah, if I want to see this film, I have to go all the way over here to get hold of it, you know. And then slowly, like, dubbed versions of Jackie Chan films and started slipping into your regular stuff. And all the kids around the way used to see it and go, this is fantastic, you know. And then someone would mention, oh, you want to check out Buster Keaton if you want to know where the history of this, you know, comes. Yeah, anyway.
Oh, great.
You get the idea. Yeah, there was kind of a similar thing.
For me, when I started to get really into the idea of cinema culture was... I started going to the BFI here, which was really like a temple for me. I guess it was called the NFT back in those days. But was when I was in school, when I came back here from the Middle East and I was at school with a guy who was really into, you know, we got into this was like the Video Nasties era.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got really fascinated by films that were banned. And similar to you, so there was one shop, which still kind of exists in a way. I won't name it now because obviously what it was doing was illegal, but you would go in and you had to be, you know, you had to be a regular or they had to trust you. So you would look at all the regular, the legal stuff on the shelves. And then at some point you could say to them, like, you know, I hear you guys have a copy of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And he would look around and, you know, he'd go on under the counter and get you like a copy of a copy of a copy, this really shitty VHS, you know, you'd pay £15 for this thing. And it became this cult. I mean, it was real like proper cult trading in videos.
Yeah.
And that for me was, I think, the first time when I started to think of film as this kind of, you know, a really precious item. It was like, oh, the British government doesn't want me to see this film. Why? There must be something good about it, you know? And I remember the same thing with the Clockwork Orange, which was a slightly different, I mean, it wasn't banned. It had been, you know,
withdrawn.
Had pulled it. Yeah. But a similar fascination. And then we would go to my friend's house and, you know, wait till his parents were out and then watch these films. And it was just like, wow. And it got me really fascinated with also taboo, you know, how we represent taboo on screen and like what society finds appalling, you know, and what does society find unacceptable. You know, that's a whole fascinating analysis of like what's the morality of a culture and how it's imposed on us.
Yeah, and in a way that probably helped form some of my mindset and politics, because the first political thing I got switched onto was anti-censorship, because I'd grown up being told I couldn't watch certain films. And then as a teenager, I got into music I was told I wasn't supposed to be listening to.
Okay.
with lots of angry black men telling the truth about what it was like living in America, and I wasn't supposed to listen to that. There was some naughty swear words in it. And that was fascinating. You know, I mean, I came of age at the time when Ice-T was facing imprisonment for writing a song about killing policemen. You know, that was such a forming experience. Because again, like you say, it's, and then we had the terrible murder that took place in this country, and the tabloid press trying to blame it on children being influenced by films. And we were so what influenced you when you joined the army then? What film did
No,
and 10 years later they pulled up outside schools in America with Xboxes trying to get kids to play Call of Duty and then sign up afterwards. So hey, maybe we were onto something.
No, I still find it ironic when we talk about, you know, when for example the British establishment will talk about the culture of martyrdom in Palestine, or the, you know, that they are obsessed with death. And then you go to the cinema and you see a recruitment ad for the military, you know, and it's made to look like a music video.
Yeah.
And I just think, I'm not, you know, what is turning a soldier into a hero if not a celebration of war and death?
Absolutely.
It's just so much more mainstreamed here.
Well, also find me, you know, with, I say Britain because I live here in America because its culture is so heavily influential, but I'm sure there's other parts of the world. Find me a place where you never get the blood and soil politics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, and
that's frankly fucking disgraceful to have a go at Palestinians about that, considering everything, the oppression that they're under. To kind of go, oh, you have a obsession with death. You know, well, what the fuck are you obsessed with, pal?
Well, and the, you know, the obsession is that of our occupier. It's not not our. I mean, they're the ones killing us. So who is the one obsessed with killing? It's, you know, it's incredible. No, it's our response is a reaction to the occupation, of course. But yeah, and just the fact that it's impossible, you know, to critique the British Army in any kind of mainstream politics, no matter where you lie on the spectrum. You still have to say, oh, well, of course. I mean, I love our heroes keeping us safer in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, with not even a second of analysis or reflection on it. So it's an incredibly narrow space for criticism.
Just a quick side issue before we talk about cinema. Yeah, on many occasion in a room I've stood in, I've said to people what my age was at the time, and said, can you name me a single conflict the British Army has been involved in my lifetime where I was ever under threat directly? And I met with a wall of silence.
Yeah.
So anyway, we could just do this for a while. Never mind cinema. But no, bringing it back around to cinema. So with that in mind, I suppose now is a good time to ask this question. Neutrality and objectivity, do these exist in documentary filmmaking? Can they exist?
Well, I don't think they need to exist, you know. So, I mean, can they exist? No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty widely recognized now that objectivity is impossible. I mean, both as an ideal, but even as a practice, because we are so influenced by the culture around us, by the mainstream representation, by our own experiences and our own prejudices. And that's fine. I mean, I think journalism should strive to acknowledge its biases, not completely remove them, because it's impossible. But, you know, not only is it impossible, I don't think it's a good goal, because we have to understand our position. We have to recognize our position, and we have to respond with that in mind. So, but I don't really consider my work journalistic anymore, I have to be honest. I still do some, you know, I work with other people who are journalists, and then my work has to be more unbiased, at least as much as possible. But no, very early on, I realized, actually with my first film, where I thought it was going to be an objective documentary, and then very quickly the man in the film started turning to me and asking me questions about why I was making the film. So I realized that there was no way this thing was going to be objective. But also was very happy with that. I mean, I realized it didn't have to be objective, you know?
Yeah. Is that the, I See the Stars at Noon? Is it that film?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I love that film. We'll come to that in a while. But,
it's the, Yeah, it's very rough, but in a way, it's the, you know, it's the most real film I've made, because it was done with, you know, maybe this is a bit nostalgic, but I had no training. I didn't have money to make it properly. It was very rough, but it's very, you know, it's very direct and raw, which I like.
So did I.
And it kind of breaks, you know, it's really made to break down this idea of how documentaries are made as well. That's what got me into more, I think, like, you know, more self-aware approach to making films. And, you know, especially when we talk about, for example, like, what is the cultural, what's the prevailing cultural attitude towards British wars? You know, why is it so difficult to dissent? And a lot of that has to do with our production of media and our production of film and entertainment and the insidious ways, sometimes unintentional, mostly intentional, that our media represents, you know, the army or the government or conflict. So I realized very quickly making that documentary that now I'm a part of that system. So what am I going to do? Either I reproduce it or I try and challenge it.
Mm. I quite agree. With that in mind, there's two other specific questions I wanted to talk to you now, if I may. Do you think there's any place? Well, no. Okay. What do you think of nostalgia? And do you think there's any place for it in filmmaking or even in wider culture?
Yeah, I do. My issue with nostalgia, I mean, I can be on an individual level, you know, I do find it it's very moving to me. You know, it can be extremely emotional. I think the problem with it is when it's either commercialized or weaponized, you know.
Yeah.
It's very often weaponized. I mean, we see it now explicitly in British politics.
Absolutely.
And it's also commercialized in the sense that there is now a nostalgia industry, you know, because we're living in a very unstable time. So suddenly we're being sold an image of what this country used to be like when, you know, not only is it untrue, but even if it were true, that image of the country was only good for a very small section of people, you know? So what I dislike is these tools in creative cinema that, of course, as soon as somebody finds an interesting way of using them, they become a commodity. So I do use nostalgia in my films. But I try and make it personal instead of institutional, you know.
Yeah.
And very often, I use it, I would say, not as a thread in the film, but just more as a technique. So I feel for me there are certain combinations of sound and image and music that remind me of certain circumstances. And if I want the audience to feel a particular emotion, then I'll exploit that, you know, in a creative way.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, see, I'm always interested in that question to people. Anyone who's listened to this show regularly, I won't bore them again, but they know I hate nostalgia. Many of the reasons you specified there, and certainly for its use as a weapon, a cultural weapon, an extremely, extremely corrosive one.
Yeah. I mean, but I think it's a shame because for me, you know, and maybe this is just specific to me, but I make films about the challenges in my perception of the world. You know, what are the challenges in the way that I want to live my life? What are the challenges that other people less fortunate than me are faced with? And for me, one of those major challenges is, as we grow up, the distance between who we are, you know, what we're doing with our lives and what we wanted to do with our lives when we were younger. That's a very powerful feeling for me in my everyday life, which means it's a very powerful feeling in my films. So there is that, for me, that kind of pure sense of psychological nostalgia that's really powerful. But it's just a shame that, you know, nostalgia with a capital N and quotes around it has just become, like you said, a very corrosive, corrupt, exploitative industry.
To me, it's basically corrodes the concept of a future. I was helped to put this together, my thoughts about this, very much by the writings of Mark Fisher. I really got into that. I went, oh, okay, now, yeah. So if I remember rightly, and correct me if I'm wrong, the event that we met at was about radical Arab cinema in particular. Is that right?
Yeah, radical Arab documentaries, actually. Very specific. Yeah, yeah.
So if I can ask you one question that kind of bundles all of those things up, where do you think radical filmmaking needs to go now? Do you think it's become less or progressively less radical, and specifically in relation to Arab documentaries?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very rich history of radical Arab documentaries, particularly militant documentaries, you know, and really specifically from the Palestine Film Unit, which were kind of the, you know, some of the godfathers of militant Arab cinema, where they made no distinction between themselves and the armed fighters that they were filming with. So they were always very clear that they were not documenting the resistance. They were part of the resistance. The only difference being that they were carrying cameras rather than weapons, but they really thought of themselves as fighters. So for me, that's a very beautiful image. And I love, you know, I love to aspire to that, that extent, the extent of that dedication. And, you know, they were not compromising in their vision. So they were still making creative, poetic films, but at the same time, these were films that were really counter-cultural, you know, really transgressive, very radical in their politics and in their form. You know, they were still quite experimental and shocking in their form. I think the problem now, especially with the Arab film industry, is that because we don't have a lot of domestic funding, so we need to get most of our funding from Europe, mostly from Europe, but, you know, foreign funding, meaning that we're constantly compromising on our vision because it needs to be palatable to European funders. So that means, you know, it can't be as radical politically. That means you compromise on the complexity of your vision because it has to be understandable to a European audience. It means a lot of the edges that might be more radical or more subversive get smoothed away. And even the process of funding in Europe, which is really dependent on these development programs, you know, once you go through two or three development programs with a film and you've had a dozen professional story consultants feed in, you know, it's a really great way of just tearing a good film apart and turning it into the most insipid, inoffensive product possible. So there's a serious issue with the funding structure. That means a younger generation of filmmakers sees what's being made and then wants to reproduce that because they see that as the way to be a successful filmmaker. So the issue is not necessarily that there aren't people who want to make more radical work. And by the way, I think all of this applies to the British film industry as well. It's not exclusively to the Arab world. The difference is there are more options here for funding than there are in the Arab world. But for sure, you know, there is a format that's celebrated. And when people see that format being successful, they want to copy it, even if they may have had much more radical aspirations in the early days. Well, I mean, you know, I think what's essential now, aside from reforming the way that films are funded, both here and in the Middle East, which is a very long-term project, is just these filmmakers need to see what else is available. They need to see other possibilities for ways that films can be made, right?
Yeah.
And as the market now is becoming more and more commercial, an independent film, I mean, if you read the BFI report in this country, it's on the verge of collapse, the independent film industry. And that's, you know, the state-funded independent. So forget about the really radical marginal film industry that isn't state-funded. So there's a lot of people who don't know what the possibilities are. They don't know other ways of making films. They don't have access to militant cinema. They're not watching really radical films. I mean, both in form and content, because they're just being pushed out.
Yeah.
Of mainstream cinemas, mainstream channels.
Which again is something I thank you and other cinemas for providing an absolutely vital channel. I'm just trying to gain a bit of self-control because I could really go off on some of what you just said there.
Do it.
No, I was just thinking, I am very, so we say, switched on about the ability for cultural access.
Mm-hmm,
it's something that really bothers me, not just within filmmaking as a good example, but also within music. And I was just thinking some of what you said there about people looking to what's available and believing that to be a successful thing, which is why it drives me mad as a youth, as a little bit of an indie rock head, to see everyone go into fucking Oasis as kind of one of the shittest bands this country ever produced, to be the basis of that, and then just coming out with this ridiculous, empty, swaggering crap. And I'm like, have you people heard McCarthy? You know, have you heard the Redskins?
Right.
I mean, go and listen to some real bands. You know, anyway, yeah. Sorry, that's just a side issue. Yeah, it really bothers me. And again, similar thing in filmmaking. I suppose I just love cinema too. It's one of the things that I'm more kind of into music these days than I was when I was a kid. I was a lot more into cinema. Since the kind of reopening of the lockdown post stuff, I started going to the cinema a lot more for a couple of practical reasons, being that the cinema I go to most often, the Prince Charles in Leicester Square, is they invested in these two big air purifying machines.
So did they?
Yeah, it felt like a much safer place to go, and they had distancing. And also, I mean, I have a lot of different music tastes, but I also like to get into the mix, as it were, get into the mosh pit. So I thought, I don't really want to do that when a lot of variations of COVID are still going around.
Yeah.
But So I started going back to the cinema a lot more in recent times. And
Prince Charles is cheap. That's a good thing as well.
It is, especially if you're a member.
You get a membership. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, it's a great place. Okay, so I suppose just one other thing, just to kind of close off that section of the end. Two questions. One is, regardless of what you were just saying there, and I won't ask you necessarily for the details of funding. I will say this much, is I'm always intrigued when sometimes I sit down to watch a film and one logo of a funding company comes up, and then another, and then another, and then another. And you think, blimey, how much money did you have to, how many companies did you have to go to gather the money to make this film? You know, even sort of what looked like fairly commercial properties to me. But anyway, that aside, of your films, which I hope to go in and talk about specifically in a minute, how many of them do you think, when you made them, and we're going back to 2005 onwards from there, do you think you'd have trouble getting made today? And I mean, not just the content, but I mean the commercial climate. Do you think you'd have problems getting them made? Or more problems?
I mean, we had problems getting all of them made anyway, so I don't even have to be retrospective about it. You know, I mean, weirdly, I think it's getting harder for me, even though I'm making more work and, you know, it's getting seen more. I think it's harder because I'm also, you know, I'm moving in a slightly different direction. So I think the last film I made is a lot less narrative than my other films. You know, it's much more abstract. And that's really what I wanted to go for, at least for now. I think partly because I've always just also had this obsession with artist filmmakers. And so there's something about the form, you know, experimenting with the form that I really wanted to get into. So the last film doesn't, you know, it's not so linear. It's not deterministic. It doesn't have a plot so much. And I love all that. So partly it's just this direction that I've always wanted to go in, but I think it's also subliminally probably a response to how commercialized and commodified the documentary industry is today, right? In the sense that, like, we have a lot of platforms, you know, there are a lot more places to see documentaries. So a lot of people are calling it a golden age of documentary film, but, you know, it's really not. All it is a golden age of commercial documentary cinema. And I wouldn't even call it a golden age. It's just the sort of apex of...
It's perhaps a better age of access. How would that be?
Sure. Yeah. But, you know, we learned that in the video revolution of the 90s that more films doesn't necessarily mean better films, and more money doesn't necessarily mean better films. So, you know, in documentary, the industry, as it does with everything, realized that you can make money off of these things. And so it's recreating them as a product and as a commodity and as content. And, you know, all of that is just utterly uninteresting to me. And I think I made this film, you know, as unlike a commodity as I could, you know, as unlike a packaged, produced, obvious, commercialized documentary as I could, because because I'm just not interested in that direction. So I almost felt like I wanted to contradict it at the same time. So, I mean, I've never had British money in any of my documentaries, institutional British money. I mean, we can talk about why that is until we all die of old age, you know, but there's so many reasons. Is it that the content is too unconventional? Is it that, you know, I'm too outspoken politically? Is it that I criticize the film institutions in this country publicly a lot, so they don't like me personally? Is it that the style of film doesn't fit? I have no idea. You know, am I not British enough? I honestly don't know. But whatever it is, you know, despite, I don't like to kind of pull rank, but, you know, despite winning big awards in major documentary festivals, it's still not, I'm still not considered, you know, an intriguing filmmaker to fund in this country. So I went to France and I got funded there. So, you know, I'm not, it bothers me because I want the film industry in this country to be better, but it doesn't bother me in a sense that I feel slighted or, you know, abandoned by my industry. For me, I would much rather put my attention into making interesting films than getting angry and wondering why, you know, why these people aren't supporting me.
Have you ever encountered that kind of classic cliche we have of the producer who basically wants to stick their oar in your work?
Yeah, actually all the time. I mean, every one of these films, I mean, I would say except there were two, I think, probably where I feel like we had complete freedom, which was amazing. That was I See the Stars at Noon, because we made it ourselves and had no, we just sold it after it was made. And even That Void, the Arctic, that really experimental Arctic documentary I made, there was almost no interference at all. With everything else, yes. And I wouldn't say from producers, because I'm very, you know, I find producers who really want to make the same kinds of films I do. Sometimes with co-producers, I would say more often it's the development process.
Yeah.
That really tries to manipulate your film to make it just to make it easier. And, you know, in a way I understand, because if their mission is to get more films made, then they'll tell you the easier way to get your film made. But I never started making films because I wanted them to be easy. In fact, it was the opposite. The first film I made specifically because it was the opposite of every other film about migrants that I was seeing, you know. So I was seeing there was a whole, you know, this was in 2004. This was at the time a kind of record wave of migrants coming into Europe through North Africa. So there were hundreds of documentaries, almost all of them by European filmmakers from the perspective of Europeans. So I specifically said, I'm going to do the opposite. So, the whole genesis of my work has always been, I'm going to do the opposite.
Let's come to that film now. I See the Stars at Noon. Just to let people know, a 2005 released film about a Moroccan man trying to get abroad illegally to make a living. I thought it was really good to see a film that, like this, for a number of reasons. One is it focused on some good times in inverted commas that he might have. You know, his life wasn't just complete misery, but unfortunately, the requirements of the modern world, or I should say, modern capitalism, made his life become substantially worse, as it does for all working people, which is something I've been trying to underline in many ways, including on this radio show with people for a long time. But I was quite moved, quite disturbed a little by the sense of isolation that, and pardon my pronunciation, but Abdel Fattah, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that he felt.
Yeah.
He seems to focus a lot in his mind about these, you know, these, what am I doing? What am I going to achieve? And he's simply just trying to get an everyday job, you know, that would pay him a little bit of money to survive. Mm. And the film really sharply reminded me of what those times were like and how many of people in my sort of political background were saying, you know, this is the race to the bottom, and you're allowing people, because you have dehumanized these people for, you know, being foreigners, that A, that's disgusting in its own mind, and B, you're just playing the game that the bosses want. And consequently, we're now involved in my workplace in a upcoming strike ballot on the basis of the fact that the suggestions they're making to our working life are absolutely scraping through the bottom of the barrel. Because they've allowed the industry to sink that way with psychotic corporations like Amazon taking everything. So yeah, a very powerful film because it was so personal. This is what I loved about it. You're focusing on one guy, very likable fella, who also turns the tables on you quite nicely. He says, why are you making this film? So why were you making this film? That's my long-winded way of getting to that question.
Yeah, I think it was that I wasn't happy with the narrative that I was seeing, you know, because so many of the films were, and this was when I was still I was still a journalist and still, you know, working for kind of mainstream news organizations. So everything I was seeing was I felt a misrepresentation in a lot of ways. You know, there was a lot of prejudice against Africans and North Africans. There was a lot of misunderstanding of why people wanted to come to Europe. There was a lot of just mischaracterization of migration. There's a lot of hypocrisy, you know, the fact that so much of Southern Europe's agricultural industry depends on irregular migrants. And then as soon as they want to assert themselves in some way, you know, they're considered criminals and they're deported and they're demonized. So, you know, it's a real stark example of what you're talking about, is this like voracious system of exploitation where we need them, you know, unless we're willing to pay more for our tomatoes and lemons, we need people like that. And, you know, that's not a good thing, but I mean, that's the way the system's been created. And as soon as you try and humanize them, you know, everybody wants to cut them down to size and victimize them. So it was partly that, which was like, I would say, a political imperative for me. And then partly just my own curiosity. You know, I really wanted to understand, because I hadn't seen it, I hadn't read it anywhere, why people would make the dangerous journey in a boat from North Africa to Europe.
Yeah, the lack of curiosity to those that oppose folks in this situation is one of the things I find most repulsive. Yeah.
And, you know, it's not difficult. It's incredible how much time, and it still happens now, you know, how much time intellectual leaders spend bullshitting about why migrants come to this country. And never once do they think to just ask them. It's not difficult. Exactly. You know, they'll give you a straight answer.
Yeah. Just one more question on this film. I understand you might not be able to answer this question. That's absolutely fine. I was just curious how you actually met Abdel Fattah.
Oh, well, I mean, the whole thing was very lucky in a way. So I had this idea to make that film. I bought a camera. I borrowed some money and bought a camera here in the UK. And then I went to a hotel in Tangier where I knew that a lot of people went through, a lot of migrants were staying at this hotel. And I said, you know, I had enough money to live for about a month in Tangier in a cheap hotel. And I said, I'll give myself a month. If I don't find someone who's willing to make this film with me, then I'll give up and go home. And I think within 3 days I met Abdel Fattah and he agreed to let me join him and film him on this journey. Oh, it was purely just luck. I mean, I just, you know, sometimes you got to do things really naively as a documentary filmmaker. So you just ask people, I'm making a film about people trying to cross into Spain. Do you want to, you know, can I film you? You become friends with them. And it was very naive. And that's why, you know, that's why halfway through the film, rightly so, he turns to the camera and says, what about me? And I have to credit the editor, Gareth Keogh, because when I first came back with the footage, I thought, oh, this stuff is useless. All this talk, you know, where he talks to camera. And Gareth realized that was really the heart of the film, was it's not an objective documentary about why people cross into Europe. It's a film about how they're represented and the power of media to misrepresent people.
The Runner. The story of a Western Sahara man who's very good at running, named Salah. Mm-hmm. The challenges he faces running around the world, representing or being prevented from, to some degrees, representing his country because of its position under Moroccan occupation. Again, just on a really basic level, I really enjoyed this film. It shows another side of people as athletes, for instance, who are another one of those group of peoples like general entertainers who we sometimes assume don't really have any kind of personal meaning or feelings. They're just there to entertain us, which is its own form of dehumanization. So Western Sahara, I don't want to draw any kind of obvious parallels, but I'm going to. So the kind of parallels between the occupation of Western Sahara and Palestine, and also in my personal experience, the use of Western Sahara as a tool by my enemies. You know, oh, well, you care about Palestine. Why don't you care about Western Sahara? I do. I care about both. I have a lot of caring to go around. What do you fucking do for Western Sahara? A lot of that I found was bound up in this film really, really well. Again, kind of what led you to make this? And were you kind of aware of Salah's story before you met him and filmed him? Or is that what led to it?
No, it started as... Oh, wow. I got to remember how it started. No, I didn't know about him. So I was invited. I got to get the details right. This was probably like early 2000s, and it would have been maybe the 30th or 35th anniversary of the founding of the Polisario. So the Western Saharan resistance movement. And I don't entirely remember how, but as a journalist working in the Arab world, I was invited to see their celebrations of the founding of the Polisario. And so we were taken to what's called the Liberated Zone. It's the part of Western Sahara that the Polisario still controls. It's not under Moroccan control. I remember just being fascinated in a similar way to I See the Stars at Noon, that this... You know, there was still a colony in Africa. You know, it's officially recognized as a still under colonial occupation. And in fact, it's under Spanish occupation because the decolonization process was never finished. So it is technically under Spanish colonization, but also occupied by Morocco as a result of this war. So, really unknown. I mean, especially here in Spain, it's much more well known as a kind of a major foreign policy issue, in France as well. But in this country, virtually unknown. And I just became fascinated by the fact that it was such a huge issue and yet was really unknown, but also how the Sahrawi assert their identity. You know, they still manifested for me this very pure sense of resistance, a very no-nonsense approach to talking about the strategies of both armed and nonviolent resistance. They represent a sense of liberation that's not tied to a kind of nationalistic chauvinism, which I found really compelling. And the fact that they kept this really ambitious independence movement alive under some of the harshest conditions in the world. You know, these are literally refugee camps of tents living in the middle of the Sahara Desert. I mean, it's incredibly inhospitable. So that in many ways, they represent a lot of this really ideal, very radical, quite socialist policies, you know, of equality, of government support, of female liberation. And it's really a surprise to see that alive today still. You know, it's a very kind of classic style independence movement that we don't really see much of anymore. And I think there someone introduced me to Salah and said, you know, he's an athlete, he's coming to Europe. Do you want to film something with him? He was coming to the UK, I think, to do a race. And I think initially I was just going to make a short news piece about him. But then I realized there was a lot more there. And so it just became a longer and longer film.
I'll tell you what, let's take a break from yours for a sec and let's just talk about some influences. I Am the One Who Brings Flowers to Her Grave by Hala Alabala.
Al-Abdallah. Yeah, Hala Al-Abdallah.
A Syrian cinematographer and director. Apparently she was arrested at 20, spent 14 months in jail. And then she moved to France and started working in films in her early 30s. Tell me about that film. Why is it such an influence on you? What do you love about it?
It just is so free. You know, it doesn't have any interest in reproducing the structures of traditional documentary. It's very subversive, you know, both in its form and this kind of, this incredible poetic, it's like a sketch. You know, I feel like she uses the camera almost like a pencil sketching. And somehow it becomes part of the vocabulary of the film. I think there's a lot of films that are made in that style, but they're very self-aware. You know, they're intentionally trying to give you this sense of rawness or immediacy. But with Hela's film, you get such a clear sense that this is how she sees the world. you know, in this kind of sometimes very slow poetic, sometimes very messy, sometimes quite rough. There's also this, especially in the interviews with women, with her female friends, there's this incredible sense of pent up anger and trauma and rage, you know, and pain that these women can find no way to express. And for me, the form of the film becomes such a beautiful reflection of that. So it's a film for me. I mean, also the fact that it's a female filmmaker and it's focused on women's experience, I think is incredibly powerful. So it's a film for me that is just so perfectly represents the experiences of the filmmakers. I find that incredibly rare. And it also, when I watched that, I felt like it gave me permission to borrow these techniques from other types of films. I'm not interested in, for example, Arab films that all they do is reproduce European films, but with Arab actors. You know, that's not innovative cinema to me. But what Hella's film does, it kind of, there are certain aspects that are clearly influenced by foreign cinema, but it's still fundamentally such a sort of Arab film. And I don't even know how to describe it, how to explain that. It just feels so real to her.
Just a little randomly, there's a couple of other things that I noted in the film. And coming back to our bit of our conversation earlier about nostalgia, one speaker I noted talks of guilt and nostalgia for the suffering of others versus her own past, which really struck a chord with me. I'm not sure if I can really articulate why. And someone else who basically turned to the camera and said, "You want to steal my thought?"
Yeah, I mean, it's a film that feels so desperate to me, and I actually love that, you know, because for me, I want to make films, and I like to watch films where I get the sense that the filmmaker just had no other option. Right? It's the only way you can see the world. It's the only way you can express how you live, how you experience the world. So I really feel that with that film, and there's such a profound sense of desperation in the people. That it's like they really want, I mean, firstly, to be free of dictatorship, but also to express themselves through their work, you know, through their art. And especially now, I find it really tragic to watch, because the way they describe dissent, you know, almost seems so naive now when we look at the civil war and mass slaughter going on in Syria. You know, it was a time when the worst thing that would happen to you is you'd end up in prison as a political prisoner, maybe tortured. You know, there was not this sense of the entire country being torn to pieces. So there's also something very heartbreaking about it. Yeah. I don't know. I could talk about it for hours. I just find it incredible.
Well, maybe we'll put that down for a possible future interview.
Yeah.
I have no problem going on about films and filmmaking, but I went off on one the other day. Because I suddenly realized how much I like and miss Bob Hoskins as an actor.
Oh, yeah?
And, I just kind of went into one. I think he had a very underrated ability, a dexterity, I suppose, for want of a better word. As in, he was far more diverse. And he bridged so many gaps. You know, I first saw him when I was a little kid in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And then I see him in Mona Lisa and The Long Good Friday, where, despite being the smallest person, especially in Long Good Friday, among quite a lot of hard nuts, he's absolutely the most dominant force in that film and the most frightening. And then recently I was slowly rewatching the film Nixon, which I have some problems with Oliver Stone, and I have some problems with his portrayal of gay men, looking back at it. But at the same time, Bob Hoskins, J. Edgar Hoover, is so compellingly repulsive that I can't take my eyes off of him. Which I honestly think Mr. Hoover was. Yeah, so I'm more than happy to talk about films for hours now. Strange Cities.
You know, Bob Hoskins went to Western Sahara, by the way. Sorry, there is a connection there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He's one of the few celebrities that actually did a film there, and he said he would dedicate his time to supporting the liberation movement.
Cool. Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do remember a small piece of footage when Maid in Dagenham was being premiered in Leicester Square, and there were some auto union workers there who were waving at him, and they gave him a cap with their logo on, and he wore it to the interview. And the journalist, you know, very nearly had a panic attack. You know, why are you wearing that? It's just because I want to, I support them.
And they probably breach their impartiality rules or some shit like that.
Yeah, well, not for the first time, so, you know, do me a favor. There's also a brilliant bit of footage on YouTube from Omnibus with Barry Norman in 1982, where Bob Hoskins posts Long Good Friday. Mm-hmm. He's walking around that area, what was left at that time of Docklands or whatever, which, of course, mm-hmm. Long Good Friday had this ludicrous suggestion that that would be turned into some kind of economic area. Who ever thought that would work? and he's going, Barry, look down this riverfront. It looks like shit, but basically all of this is going to be luxury flats at some point.
Yeah.
And like, blimey, you were saying this in 1982.
Yeah.
I think perhaps in closing, we have time just to talk about your fictional work, your short films. Strange cities are familiar, and they live in forests, and they are extremely shy. Firstly, the strange cities are familiar. You are part Palestinian. What did you find this subject affected you directly? Feel free not to answer that question if it's...
Yeah. No, I don't mind talking about it. Don't worry. I mean, it's in fact, that film is based on a lot of elements from my own life. Oh, I mean, a lot of it's also fictional, but, you know, the core characters for me represent real people, and ultimately the film's a way to try and reflect an experience, you know, and that's an experience of being in continual exile. It's an experience of this desperation to connect with your family, with your culture, and it's just a reflection of a brutal political occupation that denies people even the simplest things like seeing family. But for me, the film is much more about a sense of loss and melancholy and how we can reconcile that even when we feel we're in a state of permanent exile. You know, that longing is something that I think almost all Palestinians have, even when you have another citizenship. Even when you live a very stable, safe life in another country, there's always a sense that it's not your country. So in a way, the character of Ashraf is, you know, could be me in 30 years, for example.
And another short film with a very powerful punch about colonialism. Mm. They live in forests. Again, I guess a bit of an obvious question. What kind of brought you to make that?
It's hard to know where the idea, I mean, I think similar to all my films, I wanted to make a film that was more directly about British colonialism. And I think I was I wanted to look at the idea of visitors from colonized lands. So in a way, in a similar way that you were talking about athletes who become symbols, but, you know, they become symbols that people only want to exploit, and they only want the symbol to perform for them, and anything outside of that is considered unacceptable. So I got fascinated by this idea when I started doing research of visitors from colonized lands and how they'd been perceived. You know, and they were always perceived with this mixture of fascination and novelty, but ultimately they were always objects. And that, you know, there's no way that that's more explicitly shown than in these human zoos. And I've always felt a certain solidarity with other indigenous people of the world, right? And as they feel also solidarity with Palestinians. So when I started working with Balang, he and his wife really expressed how active they'd been in Palestinian solidarity and this real love for a kind of communal form of resistance through cinema. And that film was also, you know, very much co-created with the three First Nation artists who we worked with. You know, a lot of the detail was co-created. A lot of the emotional elements were co-created with them. So for me, it was incredible learning curve also, because it's the first time I had worked with an actor. And Balang Tommy Lewis taught me so much about respect, collaboration, you know, authority in film, how to give up some control to an artist, knowing that it will make the film more creative, it makes the film better, and also creates, you know, more solid, respectful, loving relationships with the people in the film. And it was also just really heartbreaking because he died about a year after we finished the film. And still we had this idea to make a feature version of that idea, of that film. You know, so an Aboriginal man who had worked, and based on a couple of true stories of First Nations men who had visited the UK and who had worked with the colonial authorities, but ultimately broke away. And he was also someone who had this real desperate need to tell these stories, but was working within a commercial film industry that more or less only wanted him to play certain roles. You know, he was also someone that lived between two cultures, who couldn't fully express his identity. So there were a lot of things, although our lives were very different, there were a lot of things that we found in common. And it just became an incredibly powerful experience for me. You know, I feel really blessed to have worked with him and learned so much from him, but also just an incredibly powerful experience for me as my first fiction film to work with someone who was so, you know, so moved to tears by this experience and the telling of the story. Really made me understand why, what it means for some people to make work like that, you know?
Yeah, I was struck by how incredibly powerful it was in such a short period of time. It's a very short film.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope it says a lot. That's what we wanted to do, is you say a lot in 3 minutes.
I will say, I hope that is only part one of speaking to you, because there is much more to discuss. But
I'd love to come back. Yeah.
In the meantime, Saeed, thank you very much for being on All the Rage. I love your work, and I'll see you in the cinema, mate.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Honestly, it's my pleasure and my privilege.
All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.